Want to try a free sample?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait, time to consult the online experts.
You only eat after you're walking 10,000 steps.
Stop it!
They don't know your body. Only you do. Signos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Signos.com. Signos.com with code SPARK. Signos.
Hey, folks. Delighted to bring you a special doubleheader episode today of the Lincoln Project podcast. We've got Antonia Hilton from MSNBC. She's got a terrific book about race in America. We're going to talk about that and about the media situation in the country right now. And my good friend Charlie Sykes, where we'll talk about the party that used to be called the Republicans and is now a swamp of pure madness. Thanks for joining us. We will be bringing you this doubleheader, and maybe we'll do this more in the future. People seem to like the longer episodes. So let us know, by the way, just shoot us an email, send us a message. If you like the longer episodes, we can go to the hour with more than one guest, or we can stick with the half hour format. It's up to you guys.
Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Hey, folks, welcome back to the Lincoln Project podcast. I'm your host, as always, Rick Wilson. Thanks for joining us again. We are delighted to be joined today by Antonia Hilton today. She is one of the smartest people I know and hosts The Weekend on MSNBC primetime. And it's become sort of a go-to show because the conversations there among some of the smartest people out there, you've got Ayman, you've got Catherine Pell, Elise Jordan, and you sort of steer that ship, Antonia. And you are out there every day on these weekend shows talking about big consequential issues. And obviously, it has been a show that's been pretty unafraid of talking about the tough stuff. But I, as much as we both love the show, I wanted to bring up, first off, to start off this, you wrote last year a really excellent but dark book called Madness, Race and Insanity in a Jim Crow Asylum. And I think this is something that there's been a lot of effort right now on the MAGA right to sort of completely erase history and to completely erase the one piece of history they hate the most, which is the fundamental treatment of African Americans throughout the period up to the Civil War. And after the Civil War had its own darkness. Talk to us about your book and this story first off. I want to get to some other stuff in a minute, but it's a disturbing book, but I think an important one. So tell us about the book and talk to us about that time in history where slavery was still a memory that was not hated by everybody.
That's right. You know what's interesting, Rick, is actually the timing with this book seems to have worked out well, in a way, in a disturbing way, because of the moment that we're living in right now. Madness tells the story of a Jim Crow asylum built in 1911, and the decision to build mental health infrastructure in the United States that is separated by race, to sort of purposely push Black Americans into substandard health and mental health care, comes out of a political moment that a lot of experts think we're kind of living back in right now. You know, a lot of people try to make comparisons between this moment and the McCarthy era, and I think a lot of those comparisons are very apt. But a lot of historians talk about sort of the post-Reconstruction reactionary period in the U.S. when they look at the sort of pendulum swing that we're living through right now when it comes to civil rights and race relations in the country. And one of the fascinating things about that period of our history that I don't think a lot of Americans know is that at the same time that we were passing segregation ordinances, the first Jim Crow laws in the United States, one of the other trends that sort of tick up in those reactionary moments is an abuse, assault, and sort of disrespect toward the homeless, the poor, and the mentally unwell. So at the same time that there are all these major changes happening in terms of the civil rights and sort of communal infrastructure of the United States in the late 1800s into the early 1900s, there, one of the groups that you can look at to try to understand what's happening in your society, so the health of your society, is, well, how do we treat the least among us? And it's been interesting for me talking about this book in that period while watching a moment in which, you know, we have a president who's openly trying to push homeless right. people out of Washington, D.C. We have people using really abusive and dehumanizing language about homeless people on television. I mean, Ryan Kilmeade at Fox.
Either you take the resources that we're going to give you and or you decide that you're going to be locked up in jail. That's the way it has to be now.
Or involuntary lethal injection yeah. or something. Just kill them.
Yeah, Brian, why did it have to get to this point?
Right.
Can you imagine what would have happened to you if you'd made a remark similar to that? You'd be out.
Well, I wouldn't have a job.
You would have been out. They would have called you off the set and said, thank you for your help. Bye.
Yeah. You know, the other strange thing about that moment to me, Rick, was that his co-host didn't seem that shocked by it.
Not at all.
Trust and believe that on the weekend primetime, if any of the four of us said something like that, I mean, before our bosses could do anything about it, our colleagues would have called us out right then. Exactly. And so, weirdly, this book, I think, helps us understand a lot of what we're living through right now. Madness tells the story of Crownsville Hospital, right. Maryland's Jim Crow asylum, built in 1911, in the decades after slavery comes to an end. And Maryland, but really the entire country, is engaged in these really messy debates about, well, what does sort of full participation in society look right. like for Black Americans? How are we going to manage societal ills and frustrations that people have? Doctors, lawyers, politicians in Maryland are arguing with each other about what they want to do about what they perceive to be sort of unruly Black populations that are not adjusting to freedom very well. And one of the theories that they posit is not that these communities are struggling with trauma still, and that slavery actually wasn't that long ago, and there are many people alive at that time related to or who were formerly enslaved. Mm-hmm. But it's that actually they can't handle freedom. There's something biologically very different about being Black. And so when we're going to treat those populations, we have to put them somewhere different, and we're going to manage it differently. And Maryland takes it a step further. They force homeless Black men to build this right. asylum for themselves from the ground up. They march, first it's 12 of them, but eventually it grows to a group of about 150 men and boys who are forced to clear roads, move railways, and do the backbreaking labor of building themselves their own carceral, you know, mental institution. And this book tells the about 100-year history of this place and argues that we need to understand how our mental health systems were created, the ways in which different communities and people were treated inside of them. And it'll really help us understand not just why our mental health system fails all Americans, not just Black Americans. I mean, you can meet wealthy white Americans who will tell you they're having a hard time getting addiction treatment or support for a kid struggling with depression. Sure. But I think you need to know your history first to figure out what our solutions might look like in the present. And that's really what Madness is all about.
You know, I find one of the things I found really frightening about it or disturbing about it was, folks, in that period of time in American history, even the most posh, private, whites-only mental institution, by today's standards, you would say was a hell on earth. You would be mortified in every possible way about the treatment of those folks there. This was something even more horrific and administered weirdly with that voodoo race science approach of, as you said, the idea that Blacks did not have the cognitive ability to adjust or to exist in freedom, which, you know, Jim Crow was like a persistent virus that kept trying to reintroduce the worst aspects one at a time to say, we're not going to do slavery, but we will do sharecropping. We're not going to overtly do it, but we're going to gussy it up in a pretend world. And as a guy from the South, who has been down that rabbit hole of, I mean, Black prisons in Florida had a death rate that was higher than people being put in the electric chair or hanged for there because of disease and treatment. And so this sort of thing, it reminded me of just how sweeping that as a cultural institution Jim Crow was throughout. And even in Maryland, you do not think of Maryland as the Deep South, but it is, but it was, you know, this story was pretty dark. When you wrote this book, I presume since it was released in, well, I guess late last year, right? It you would have been doing this.
Yeah, about a year and a half ago. Yeah.
You would have been doing this before the current moment of excesses of trying to erase history, trying to eliminate Black history in the Smithsonian and in the classroom and everywhere else. And if you were writing it again now, would it have changed your perspective on much of the stuff you reported in this book? Because I think we've jumped up a level that is kind of ugly since that period.
We have definitely jumped up a level, but I will tell you, I think a lot of it holds.
Sure.
Up.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Because what one of the ways in which so for background for anyone who's new to my work, before I started anchoring at MSNBC, I was at NBC for 5 years, and my beat was covering sort of the culture war in K through 12 education. And so I was there ground zero for the CRT fight, the sort of first iteration of book banning at the local level. And of course, this had sort of national connections. There were, you know, members of Congress who were in the wake of George Floyd's killing and the publishing of the 1619 Project, you know, freaking out about this at the top level. But there was this organic or semi-organic, because there were certainly organizations bankrolling a lot of this and trained activists who were involved at times. But there were parents who were starting to have this very emotional backlash. They were worried about children feeling guilt about learning certain things in schools. And so I kind of saw where this was going to go, I guess. I wasn't shocked when Trump won. I had seen the sort of local grassroots mobilization centered around schools and parents in some of these communities really fire the sort of cultural shift and the political shift in the country. And so I was not shocked and bamboozled and confused, in part because I had done so much of that reporting. And this book was, you know, I was finishing it up and I was getting ready to bring it out into the world in that very environment. And so I think in many ways it holds up, I guess. I don't know that I would do anything differently. Maybe I would have ended it with a reflection on some of what we've seen happen in just the last 3-4 months. I end it right now with Jordan Neely and his killing in New York City and the debate that inspired across the country. But to be honest, I think that people will find that if you read this book without knowing the day that I published it, it would feel like it still makes very much sense to you right now. That's my gut
feeling.
And
I do think that then and now, a fundamental underpinning of pathologies in all kinds of communities, African-American community and everywhere, has been that we have never figured mental health out in this country. Now, not just in the era when it was deliberately abusive and racially segregated like that, we have never figured it out. And so much of the stuff that we struggle with in cities and states around this country is that we don't have a mental health system in this country. We have this weird ad hoc patchwork. Sometimes you can't get help or treatment depending on your income. And as you point out, even upper income people have trouble. There's a critical shortage of mental health beds in this country, no matter where you're from. It's worse in urban and minority communities, but it is a broad problem that we just have not tackled as a country.
Oh yeah. One of the things I write about at the very beginning of the book is how during the pandemic, while I was writing this, a family member of mine started to experience psychosis. Mm-hmm. And my family, I'm one of 7 kids. We all have good jobs and good health care. I have, you know, tons of aunts and uncles, like 30-something cousins. So when this loved one started going through a hard time, we had resources. We had people on the phone. I mean, I have uncles who are doctors who were calling people and trying to get favors done for this person, right? Like, that's the level of resources we had at our disposal. And still, my loved one was put on a 6-to-8-month waiting list in order to get inpatient care. And they were told, for example, that, oh, when you come in for your interview to finally get into this facility, if you fail it, you have to go back to the beginning of the line. And, oh, because of the nature of their psychosis, they very likely may fail it.
Yeah.
How does that make sense?
It's a very broken system. So
broken.
So I want to jump to off of the subject of mental health and onto a subject that is making people crazy in the political way. As a person in the media, you must have been watching very carefully the last few weeks as the FCC has started to threaten folks who say things that make Donald Trump upset. And while Jimmy Kimmel is back on the air, it took an awful lot for Disney. It took them losing $4.7 billion of equity and their parks to empty out and Disney Plus memberships to crash through the floor to make that change. As somebody who's in the front line in the media, talk to me about the pressure you guys feel. I think MSN is probably a little different than most outlets, but talk to us about that pressure that the media is feeling in this post-truth world of Trump and the FCC running sort of a political interference for the White House.
Yeah, I think everyone in our field is exhausted, a bit fearful about what's going to come next, about how all of this will develop. You know, as you said, at MS, we're in a different position because while the FCC has some involvement with cable, nowhere near what they can do to broadcast, of course, we're in the process of divorcing from sort of a larger NBC Universal Comcast family right now. So that's going to put us in a different position because, you know, we won't have the same level of, you know, sort of federal corporate partnership there. You know, MSNBC doesn't have to deal with the federal government to run a theme park or, on certain lands or to put cables
right
down. So I think it puts us in a different position. But that doesn't mean that we don't have to be really careful. I know that all the reporters right now, I mean, I work with incredible people who,
sure,
who do great work no matter what, but we lean on our legal and standards department. We're really just aware of both the verbal and physical threats that can come our way, but also the sort of bigger picture of how this administration views the work of journalists.
Right.
A lot of us are talking, and this is not just at MSNBC, I mean, all my friends in the field, talking about, like, when is the moment going to come when all of these newsrooms get together and figure out a strategy to support each other? You know, is it just going to be lawsuits over here and lawsuits over there? Or will there be a unified strategy at some point? I think one of the things that makes that strategy challenging is that this is a very tiered business,
oh,
too,
yeah,
where, I mean, this is an ABC story, right? Where you're seeing the power of Disney and Bob Iger, but also the power of Nexstar
and Sinclair.
And Sinclair and the fact that, exactly, you know, these are really sort of powerful entities that are going to shape the way all of this turns out. And so how do the journalists themselves, the people doing the day-to-day work, figure out how to support each other? The conversations are happening. I wouldn't say all the resources and the plans are there. I wish they were. But the bottom line is we all do still feel that we have an obligation to keep covering the stories, to take care of and check on each other.
Yep.
Like the sort of background support we all provide each other has been incredible. And we're figuring out on just like a one foot in front of the other basis, how to keep serving our audiences and being fearless while also keeping ourselves very safe. And so that we can be in this field and do this work for the long term. And that is hard. It can be exhausting. I am currently out of New York City, taking a little bit of a break for a
right
few days because I anchored many hours of coverage this past week around Charlie Kirk's
sure
memorial service. It was really challenging work. You know, there were people on the ground there, colleagues who were talking about the security concerns at the event. These are very real things,
oh, yes,
that affect all of us, and we go home and we take it home with us. So the other piece of it is just figuring out, like, how am I as a human being going to get through it? And what are the things I need to do in my day to day to just make sure I'm good and I can come back and take another, you know, pass at it the next day? Yeah, it's, I don't know. Sometimes when I remind myself that we have years in this fight to go, it can be really hard.
That is a reality, though. We have miles to go on this fight. So I want to talk a little bit about the weekend because I love the show and I love the conversation. And I think that MSN has built out a few shows that are that more conversational beat thing. It's not just the three box of guys remotely. It's very smart people with unique perspectives, all bringing something to the table. Talk to us about how the show's been going, and how do you, how you like interacting with the other folks that you work with there.
Oh, the show has been so much fun. To be honest with you, when I first got the opportunity, I was kind of terrified. I've been an outdoor cat for many years. I get to travel all over the place. I'm on planes. I live out of a suitcase, or I lived out of a suitcase. And so, you know, I kept thinking, like, really? You want me on the show? Like, I don't know. I don't even know, you know. I had never really read prompter before.
Right.
There were all these basic pieces of doing the job that I was like, oh, man. But it has been a blast. First, you know, Eamon and I have been friends since I came to NBC 5.5 years ago. So I knew, like, I know him. He's such a foreign policy expert, so interesting to talk and debate with. So I knew he had the experience, and that was going to be a lot of fun. I'd followed Catherine Rampell and her work at the Washington Post for a long time. I knew how smart she was. I knew that I would learn from her. The show started in the midst of, like, all the tariff wars just getting started. So every day we were all like, Catherine, help us. What's going on? And then Elise Jordan, I knew because she's been like a morning show regular for a long time. Also so interesting. She just from her own career and work in the government, but also from the work that she's done focus grouping. Yep. She brings like such a great perspective, and she's always so interested in bringing cool guests on and unique people who she's worked with in the past. And so I think her voice and her perspective with, you know, the libertarian Republicans as well, just is a needed voice on our show. And so we have just such a really good group, and we have a really dedicated audience too, of people who know that because of the time that we have on the weekend, 3 hours, Saturday and Sunday, we're going to get to cover ground other shows don't get to Monday to Friday. We can dig into some things that maybe when everybody's hair is on fire during the work week, they forgot to talk about or couldn't really guest around. We get to a lot of that material, and we can dig in and dig deep. And so I think that's what's making the show really special, and we're starting to just feel that gelling now a couple months into it. And now I finally feel like, oh, I deserve to have this job. I can do it.
But I do think that longer conversational format with smart people, and yes, you have good guests, bang, you know, in and out, but that longer conversational format is, I think, something that appeals to people who they may take a lot of their news in bites from social media or whatever, but humans want to talk. Humans want to work the problem. Humans want to tear things up, you know, apart and look at things up and down and sort of get other perspectives. And you watch that chemistry emerge. I think it's really been, like a backbone of the show. I really like it.
Thank you. Yeah. I come from, before I came to NBC, I was at Vice for a long time doing long form sort of documentary style reporting. And so while this is so different from that, one of the things I do like about it is that long form feeling where we have time to explain an issue to our audience. We can keep a guest around for two or three blocks if that's what we want to do because we have the time. And I do think people are really hungry right now for this feeling like they are connected to you in an authentic way. They're engaged in a conversation with you. We get feedback from our viewers, good and bad. They're always willing to reach out to us on every single platform. The MSNBC audience is super engaged and passionate, and we are so lucky to have that. And so, you know, with that comes the responsibility of like every week wanting to make sure that we hit the conversations that matter to them, that we represent the viewpoints that they need to hear and have the debates that they want to see explored, and that we get the guests and the lawmakers and the people on who they want to learn from. So, you know, it's this good thing. And then it also really raises the stakes where every week I'm like, I'm on it. Like, okay, Saturday and Sunday, all my friends are relaxing, but I'm like, I'm in high gear. But I know that's a blessing.
That is a blessing. I think that's right. But so listen, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. I really appreciate it as always. And tell folks where they can reach you on social media.
You can reach me pretty much everywhere. I am under Antonia Hilton, A Hilton26 on everything. I also have a website, antoniahilton.com, where you can send me emails, whether that's about my book, my reporting, stories you want to see covered at MSNBC. I love to hear from everyone.
All right.
And thank you, Rick, for having
me. Absolutely delightful,
this was
as always. I'll see you on TV.
I'll see you on TV too. Bye, Rick.
Thanks. All right.
Hi, guys. Here's my morning routine. First, I drink olive oil, like a lot of it. Yep, that's good. Then I stare at a red light. It's the kind that helps your cells positively glow. Oh, wow, really bright. Okay. Next, I take an ice bath. That's how you melt your fat and fix your, I don't know, other stuff. Ooh, yep, feeling super healthy. Can't fit my toes. Breakfast is raw liver. Okay, here we go. Oh, real good.
If your health advice sounds strange coming from a kid, maybe it's just strange. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. No fads, no fear, just your signal. Get $10 off select plans at cygnos.com. That's cygnos.com with code SPARK. Cygnos.
Hey, folks, welcome back to the Lincoln Project Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Rick Wilson. Glad you're joining us once again for our good conversations with smart folks in the pro-democracy movement. And my favorite of those folks is Charlie Sykes. He and I are refugees from a party that no longer exists, now governed by a mad king. And Charlie, I wanted to start out with this idea that Donald Trump's unpopularity is an underappreciated problem for the Republican Party right now. Because this guy is underwater on every issue, including his signature issue, immigration, right now. Talk to us about where you see, like, Trump's political strength. I'm trying to make the case that his political strength, outside of just being president, is vastly overcounted right now.
No, I think that, and yes, I agree with you. By the way, good morning. It's good to talk with you again, Rick. A lot of his power, depends on his perception of being powerful. And, so many of these institutions have caved in because, like, they tell themselves he's irresistible, right? I mean, he's so dominant. And so it creates that aura that somehow he's got this wave behind him. But I wonder, and I wanted to bounce this off you as well, that even as these numbers come in showing how thin his support is and how he's underwater on some of his key issues, he doesn't seem to care that much, does he? And I think there's something a little bit alarming about this, that Donald Trump seems to be acting like a guy who says, I have the power. I don't need to be popular. Interesting take for a populist, by the way. And I think that the way they're going about the gerrymandering and everything, part of me thinks that Donald Trump doesn't even look at those top line numbers. What the question that he's asking, his homunculus, Stephen Miller, is, well, how am I with the base? Is the base still with me?
Right.
Is the base? And as long as the base is with him, he feels that he's got, that he can do anything. I mean, he is behaving as if he can do anything, and he doesn't seem to give a shit about persuading, reaching across, moderating, pretending. At all.
No. I keep looking at that number on inflation and prices, 27 points underwater on it. Absolutely catastrophic. And yet 35-40% of this country believes that we are in an economic golden age. And they wake up in the morning and go, "Oh, it's so much better now. We're getting paid so much. I can't wait to get my $5,000 Doge check." All the, like, that fantasy bubble. One thing I've been sort of watching for, and I think we're seeing the earliest signs of it, there is some cracking going on in, like, with the farm folks in rural communities who are like, oh, wait, they really are closing our hospitals. Oh, wait, we really are going to lose our farm because of the tariffs. But I don't know that it's, I don't know that it's ever going to crack that infrastructure of MAGA reinforcement online and with Breitbart, Fox, everything else.
No, and there's such a vast network right now. You know, when you and I first started talking about this back in, it feels like the before times, you know, right. When things seemed really, really bad, but now seem kinder, gentler era. I'm talking about like 2016, 2017. This ecosystem is much bigger. It is much more powerful. It is much more hermetically sealed than it ever has before. That doesn't mean that there's not going to be some internal divisions in it. I mean, you see, you know, some of the folks breaking off over the Epstein files. There is real anxiety, I think, in rural America. You know, here in Wisconsin, people are starting to realize that if you're raising soybeans, you are royally being screwed by these tariffs. But I guess the question is this tribalism, is this tribal loyalty so intense that, yes, they can be unhappy about X, Y, and Z, but ultimately they're going to stick with the team, especially because I'm looking at these same numbers and people are, there is a group that is having regret, buyer's remorse about voting for Donald Trump, but they are not yet sold on the Democrats. They are not going, okay, we think, yes, Trump sucks. We are alarmed by Trump, but they're not persuaded yet that the Democrats are a better choice. And I think that's kind of the Rubik's Cube puzzle that we have to work through here.
Well, you know, when you see Schumer and Jeffries going to the White House on the shutdown issue, and this may air after the shutdown debate has ended, but you see them going to the White House, I'm like, well, we want you to preserve the Affordable Care subsidies. And imagining that Trump will not break any deal he makes with them. I mean, Charlie, this to my mind, it's like our old party, you know, say what you will about the fascism, but our old party, the discipline of wanting to win is like an ultimate underpinning value of that party. The Democrats, I cannot imagine how they walk into a meeting with Trump and think, okay, we're going to negotiate in good faith with this guy. He's going to tell the truth and keep a deal that we make with him. Yeah, it's ludicrous.
I mean, that would be the definition of insanity. Now, I'm not sure that they actually think they're going to get a deal. Maybe they're just going through the kabuki dance. I mean, these shutdown debates are always these long kabuki dances that go on and on and on and that are eventually resolved. I'm not sure that's the case this time. But I think that at a certain point, you have to say, well, we tried, we negotiated, we sat in the Oval Office, we made a good faith effort.
Right.
But if Chuck Schumer thinks that there is any sort of a deal or compromise, then he's completely delusional. I actually wanted to use a much stronger word there to that. I mean, look, we've seen a lot of political malpractice, but that would be the worst. And the point you're making is crucial. First of all, Donald Trump's not going to blink on this right now. That's number one. Number two, whatever he promises, it means nothing. I mean, we're in the process right now of the Trump administration with the Supreme Court's apparent acquiescence is saying, mm-hmm. We don't give a shit what Congress appropriates. We don't care what's actually in the budget. We think that we have the power to spend or not spend as we choose. So what is the point of making a deal with somebody
exactly. Who
is in the process of saying deals, budgets, laws don't matter to us?
That Charlie, to my mind, is absolutely like the key point here. The rescission argument that Russ Vought has been making since the drafting of Project 2025 has been the president can do anything he wants. All executive offices belong to him. All power belongs to him. And once you authorize and appropriate those funds, they belong to him at his discretion. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm just, to my mind, it's like, if you're Schumer or Jeffries or both, my argument would be you walk in there and you say, okay, Mr. President, you're only going to get a deal if you undo the tariffs. Mm-hmm. Cause then they could go to America. They could go to the country and say, hey, we saved you. Cause let me tell you, no farmer in America who's voted for Donald Trump twice or three times wakes up and goes, man, I can't wait to hear more about the climate plan or the gun control plan for the Democrats. They do care about the fact they're going to lose their goddamn farms. And mm-hmm. to my mind, it's just like,
yes,
this is a layup. And I cannot figure out why they can't walk in and go, yeah, sorry, chief, but you need our votes. You need enough of our people to vote for you. It's not going to work unless you end the tariff war.
Yeah. There's no
brag about saving America.
Yeah, but I mean, he's not going to do it. There's going to be no deal. So the question is, you know, what flag do you plant your, you know, what flag are you going to plant on this particular hill?
Right.
My look, I am come around. I was a little squishier earlier this year. I didn't like when Schumer went along with it. I think that was the fight that Democrats wanted. I think it was the fight they needed, but it was a fight they couldn't win, and the timing was not right. I don't think they have a choice. Right. I think they have to not go along. You cannot fund the Donald Trump government. You cannot.
No.
You cannot sit there and vote with everything that is going on. And, you know, we can talk about healthcare. We can talk about tariffs. We can talk about troops on the street. We can talk about receding. All of those things. You cannot do that. My big question to you and to them is, okay, once you do this, what is your exit strategy? How does it end? I mean, so you have this game of political chicken. I mean, and I don't see anybody swerving. So, I mean, I actually was having flashbacks to, remember when Ted Cruz wanted to shut down the government and everybody, all the people on the right, were all excited about it. And there were actually a few Republicans who started asking questions like, okay, how do we get out of this? Because Obama is not going to repeal Obamacare. It's just not going to happen. So what's your strategy here? And the answer was Ted Cruz didn't have a strategy. He didn't have any.
Right. The answer was humana.
So I do think, I don't know. I'm not saying they shouldn't do it, because they absolutely have to do it. I mean, this is a break the glass moment. You know, you want to talk about red lines, you know, you have to do this, and you can't be intimidated by the threats from Trump and vote that there's going to be mass firings, because you know what, you know, they're going to fuck with the federal workforce anyway.
Right. Watch what happens if they give in on the mass firings. Then vote says, you know, because I woke up on the wrong side of the bed today, we're going to fire all these people anyway, and see if the Supreme Court stops us, because it won't. It won't.
No, and I have to admit that Supreme Court decision, and again, it was on the emergency docket, that the Supreme Court, if it was looking to restrain what's going on, this would have been an easy one, because I think that this has been a solid legal principle that the president cannot simply impound money. Okay, you know, that Congress still does appropriate money. It's also a fundamental constitutional question: is, you know, does the unitary executive turn Congress into a potted plant? And once again, the Supreme Court has whiffed on this. And so, and I expect them to whiff on tariffs as well.
What blows? I keep calling it the red court for a reason. It is not. I had an argument with a MAGA-ish person the other day, and I said, you are not looking at a conservative Supreme Court. No. The court you're looking at was the court you always said you hated. They're a hyper-activist Supreme Court empowering the executive disproportionate to any reading of the founders or the Constitution.
You know, you and I have talked about this in the past, and I am increasingly frustrated by the use of the word conservative to describe what's going on with the court or the administration. You know, that, and I'm also frustrated with the people who will say that, well, this is the logical conclusion of 50 years of conservatism.
Yeah, no.
This is an abandonment of conservatism. There is nothing conservative. This is radical of right-wing ideology. And by the way, the whole idea of originalism, you know, that the conservatives talk about, you know, what did the founders mean when they wrote this? Let me tell you something. What the founders' original intent was, no king, right? The founders did not intend to have a president who would rule by decree, impose taxes without the consent of the governed, would be able to send troops into towns and villages and cities. This was specifically what the founders intended to prevent. They created 100%. This vast structure to prevent someone like Donald Trump from being in the presidency. And then if he was in the presidency, to act like an unchecked emperor. That is the fundamental originalist interpretation of the Constitution.
100%, Charlie. I could not agree more. Mm-hmm. That idea, you know, and God knows I geeked out about it 8 or 9 months ago, and I went back and I read Federalist Papers and Anti-Federalist Papers and a whole bunch of other stuff.
Me too.
And the constant caution
mm-hmm. with the founders, the constant sense of caution of avoiding a tyrant, avoiding a king,
yes.
avoiding an all-powerful ruler, it was omnipresent.
Yes.
And even when they talked about the power of the executive in like Federalist 10 and Federalist 51, they were still bounding and controlling and constraining the power of the executive because they all believed that if you let a man have that much power, he will take more and take more and yes. take more. Thus, it has always been with authoritarians. And you go back and look at Washington, who could have become all-powerful and said,
easily.
Nope, stepping back, done now. This is it. You don't need me for a 10th term. You don't need me for a 5th term. I'm going to do the job that a democratically elected leader in a republic should do, and then I'm going to go home. And I feel like we're getting less and less of the Trump will argue to stay in power after this is over from a legal perspective and just be a gambler, because he's a gambler. He'll just say, fuck yep. it. I'm going to call out sometime in 2027 or 8. He'll say, I need all Republican people who want to run for president someday to come and swear a loyalty oath to me because I'm sticking around. You stole a term from me, so I'm sticking around. I mean, I really believe he's going to try something. And even if he doesn't think it'll work, try January 6th. And weirdly, in the end, it worked.
Weirdly, in the end, it worked. And by the way, he's still trying to rewrite the history of January 6th. You know, I have been very, very skeptical about this, sort of the alarmist view of Trump, a 3.0. I'm starting to come around to it because one of the big failures that we've had is the failure of imagination, to imagine how bad Donald Trump could be, what he could yep. do. Even those of us who had a pretty dark view, but I think that there was this sort of the smart kids who said, well, take him seriously, but not literally.
But not literally.
Well, surely he won't do this. And well, there will be constraints. There will be constraints. Look at the
Mitch
checks
McConnell
and balances.
Will stop him.
Yeah. Well, at this point, see, actually, I wrote something on Monday about this, about the failure of imagination of Republicans that yeah. who are acting right now as if they will never have to give up power because, if they need to sit back and go, imagine if you're okay with Donald Trump exercising this kind of kingly imperial power, how would you feel if it was AOC? How do you feel if it's AOC who controls the Department of Justice? How do you feel if it's Gavin Newsom who turns the FBI into his personal cudgel? What would you imagine if a Democrat could impose taxes or bully companies in the way that Donald Trump is doing right now? Not to mention the criming, the corruption, the grift. There's a reason why authoritarians don't like to give up power. It's like riding the tiger because they're afraid that if they get off, it will eat them. They are acting as if they will never have to turn over the reins of power to Democrats who would have the kind of power they do, which makes me think that scenario of Donald Trump in 2020. And by the way, what Republican will stand up against him and say, no, you can't?
Right. Anybody think
which
J.D.
Republican?
Vance
Name
or Marco
one.
Rubio is going to go, no, sir, can't do that.
And you know what? I was actually thinking about this last night. So the Supreme Court, let's just say the Supreme Court says, no, the Constitution's pretty clear in this. You can't do it. Donald Trump says, you know what? Let's let the states decide. Let's right. let the people decide. And one Republican legislature after another will go, yeah, we're going to put him on the ballot. We're going to do that. And we'll see what happens with the Electoral College. I mean, we're at the point now where we have to use this imagination in order to do it. I mean, Gavin Newsom's about the only guy out there right now saying, I really worry about 2028. And I think it's about time.
Yeah, and I tried to, I told people for a while, like, he's going to be so old at that point. This job wears everybody down, even the worst of us.
That's what I thought, yeah.
And it's funny, a friend of mine sent me a picture of me and him and George W. Bush back in 2000. And
yeah,
some of them
young guys, yeah.
And I'm like, I was like, yeah, I look like I was in my late 30s, right? And then, but I looked at George W. Bush, and he looked like he was like 40.
Mm-hmm.
He looked young. Yeah. And then you look at the pictures of him as he left, and it's just like the office wears you down. But when in Trump's case, I don't think he governs the same way, doesn't have the sense of responsibility other leaders have traditionally had. So he just sort of, I mean, the guy's either going to die in a month or he's going to die at 105 years old, is my theory of the case. And that idea he could hang on, man, that's got to really be addictive to him.
Well, it is. And look, I'm not predicting it's going to happen, and I'll be glad if I'm wrong about this, but I think
I want to be wrong.
You need to start creating these guardrails. And, you know, I look back and I don't want to be like, you know, make too much of a digression here. One of the real failures of the Biden years was that they had the failure of imagination. They did not batten down the hatches. They did not pass the legislation that would protect the vote or, you know, protect all of these abuses. And it was because what? They thought that the fever had broken. You could move back. The old norms were safe. We didn't have to be concerned about that. And I think that's part of the problem. We cannot make that mistake again. You have to fire. If democracy is ever going to come back, or the rule of law, a constitutional republic, it's got to fireproof itself this time. And we have to have discussions like this. Okay, let's fireproof the Constitution, because let's imagine what the next threat is going to be. And let's not pretend it's not going to happen.
There's a degree, I think that's so right, Charlie. There's a degree of you know, you kind of need to do at the end of Trump. And folks, I think there will be an end to Trump. There will be an end.
Sure.
But we do have to do basically like a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We have to look at the abuses of power that occurred in the last 12 years on Trump's part, while he's in and out of office, and say to ourselves, okay, if we're going to play by the rules that our founders in this amazing inheritance left for us, we can't do the following things again. And some of it is just like, I mean, look, I think one of the reasons Trump ran again was just the money. He just wanted, he saw the first time he didn't monetize the presidency, and this time he has. I think one of the reasons he ran was the legal protection. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court is now saying that precedent doesn't really matter anymore. Clarence Thomas said it explicitly this
weekend. Clarence Thomas, yep. Mm-hmm.
He said it explicitly. Well, you know, the stare decisis, maybe it's just people making stuff up. Well, then, okay, then I hope that Trump v. United States, the get-out-of-jail-free card that Trump was given by the Supreme Court, is something we don't think of as precedent. Because this country, as a constitutional amendment, that would be one of my top ones to put out there in the world, is that no president is above the law, in civil or criminal.
See, I didn't think we needed a constitutional amendment to establish the principle that no president was above the law. I thought that was there, right?
Yeah,
we all thought
it was. Sort of took it for granted for 240 years, but you know, here we are.
Yeah.
So
that would be a good birthday present for the 250th birthday party, though.
Wouldn't it? Yeah. Wouldn't it, though?
250th birthday party, say, hey, by the way, we don't have kings who are above the law. Okay?
100%. So if Trump does go, I think there's going to be another different moment in the country politically. I think the Hunger Games on the right are going to be insane. If Trump, let's say Trump drops dead on, you know, on Christmas Eve, 2027, and there's an open field for 28. I think the Hunger Games are going to be utterly insane. I think Don Jr. or Eric will get in. I think you've got Rubio, you've got Vance, you've got, you know, all these other guys who've really wanted to be president. The, you know, the Hawleys, the Cottons, Tucker Carlson, all these folks that are going to come out of the woodwork. What do you see that landscape looking like when this moment comes?
I agree with you. I think it's going to be a free-for-all. I mean, I think you have too many little... Now, you have the imperial presidency, but you have all of these duchies, all the dukes and the barons, yes. and they're all... okay, but as you were thinking it through, and this is not something I want to contemplate, okay, Rick? But you see, you take me into these dark places. If it's Christmas Eve 2027... And the great martyr Donald Trump passes from the world, is there any way that Donald Trump Jr. does not become the Republican nominee.
No chance. I don't see it.
He says,
I must carry on my father's legacy. While I respect J.D. Vance, there is no one who knew my father's heart better than his own son. And the name ID and Lachlan Murdoch at that point will go, cha-ching. And it's an easy fit for the populist part of the MAGA base. And I think the AOC Donald Trump Jr. race will be one for the ages.
Oh no. Oh geez.
Right.
I think by then I'm gonna need to live on an island in the north.
Yeah, I'm gonna get rid of my phone at that point.
No. Well, again, that's the failure of imagination on the part of Republicans. I mean, I really do think that I would like to have a conversation with a MAGA enthusiast saying, all right, let's talk about AOC having the kind of power that you're okay with Donald Trump having. The reason I'm saying this is going back to the conservatives used to understand why you wanted a small government, why you wanted a limited government, why you wanted constraints on the power of the state over the private sector and over individuals, why the process mattered and the importance of Congress and the deliberative body as opposed to one man rule. This whole idea of conservatives deciding that they really like the imperial presidency based in Washington, D.C., that overrides local governments and state governments is
remember that whole thing, the government that's best is closest to the people?
Oh my God, yes. No, we conservatives said that all the time. Not to mention that conservatives actually wanted to conserve things as opposed to blow things up, destroy things. And there was something, and this full frontal attack that Trump has now joined in, that America is not, you know, the exceptional city on the hill, that America is not an idea, that, you know, blood and soil. Again, this was always out there, but it was not something that I ever thought was the mainstream of conservatism. And I want to say this for our progressive listeners here, because I think when you say that, well, you know, this is just the same as conservatives always were.
No.
Well, that's what Trump would like to convince a lot of conservatives out in the country. That, like, you're a Republican, you're a conservative. We have R after our name, right? We are doing just the same thing that you always wanted us to do. And I think there's a really important point saying, don't buy into their spin. Their spin is that they are part of this tradition. The reality is this is a radical departure. These are revolutionaries. These are people who are overturning centuries of American values. They are not conserving American values. They are torching them. They are obliterating them.
And you're so right, Charlie. It's exactly the opposite. And as guys who lived through the eras of Reagan and Bush 41 and W and the Republican emergence as a national political party in the post-Nixon era. Yeah. None of these people. I didn't know Ronald Reagan personally, but I knew 41 and I knew W. I worked for 41. And these were men who would reject the things that Trump has done categorically. They would have not only no, but hell no. There wasn't critique those guys all you want, Democratic friends, but not one of those men wanted to stay in power forever. Not one of those men.
John
thought
McCain
he was
wouldn't
king
be doing this.
Mitt Romney wouldn't be doing this sort of thing.
You may hate these guys, but no, this is not what the kind of presidency they would have. Now, Richard Nixon, who, by the way, actually did have a foreign policy that was coherent. Unlike Donald Trump, you have to listen to the secret tapes to find out some of the things that Richard Nixon has done. Richard Nixon believed when you're the president, you can't break the law. Donald Trump is saying, fuck it. When you're the president, you can do anything. In fact, not only can I not break the law, it's not a scandal. And that's what I thought about the whole Jimmy Kimmel thing, you know, from a couple of weeks ago, is that it's a little bit like, you know, Watergate every day on blast, on big loudspeakers. Yes, we have an enemies list. Yes, we're going after Jim Comey. Yes, I'm going to use
We're not ashamed of it.
No, I'm like, yeah, damn right we have an enemies list, and damn right we are going to order the Department of Justice to indict them regardless of the facts, regardless of the law. I mean, it's just
the abuse of power at scale is something that has never Nixon's stuff was trivial, like Bush League, you know, triple A ball stuff. And this is the World Series of corruption right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's nothing constraining, even among the ambitious people who want to run for president, none of them are saying, you know, this could not work. This might not work out so well for us, you know, because we're going to have to defend. Did Donald Trump make billions of dollars while he was in office? Did Donald Trump use the power of government to punish his political enemies? The answer is going to be yes across the board. And I can't wait to see Marco or Vance or all these other people getting sweaty. One thing they all lack is that utter sense of shamelessness that Trump has.
They're working on it.
Vance is pretending he's shameless, but he's not really shameless. Trump just does not give a damn. And I'm curious how that's going to play, because it's hard to scale Trumpism. It's hard to It's hard to copy it. Why do you want Diet Trump? If you want, you know, why would you elect Marco or Vance? Why do you want the diet version of Trump? It's really, I find it like all these guys that are faking it, because you and I both knew J.D. Vance when he was a part of with us in the Never Trump movement.
I'm a Never Trump guy. I never liked him.
It makes you think that at a fundamental level, this is sort of a he said, she said, right? And at the end of the day, do you believe Donald Trump, who always tells the truth? Just kidding. Or do you believe that woman on that tape?
No, I cannot stand Trump because I think he's a fraud. Well, I think he's a total fraud that is exploiting these people, who is a total fraud.
Like you said, I agree with you on Trump because I don't think that he's the person. I don't think he actually cares about folks.
Definitely, there is definitely an element of Donald Trump's support that has its basis in racism or xenophobia.
I think there's a chance, if I feel like Trump has a really good chance of winning, that I might have to hold my nose and vote for Hillary Clinton. I think I'm going to vote third party because I can't stomach Trump. I think that he's noxious and is leading the white working class to a very dark place.
And so this guy, they're all faking it. I'm just curious, like, I wonder how long they can hold that illusion together once he's gone.
Oh, I think they're going to look radically diminished when he's gone. You see, I think that you're right about this. Look, Marco Rubio, and look, I remember there was a period where I actually did believe that Marco Rubio was the future of the Republican Party, and that, you know, that, remember that he was on Time Magazine. You know,
I was working to get him elected.
No. And yet when he ran for president, he was suddenly exposed as an empty suit, you know, a week, and he's exposed himself that way. So I'm not sure that you audition to become the next Donald Trump, the next emperor, by basically being the complete toady. So these guys are going to look very, very shrunken, which is why that Don Jr. thing. Now, Don Jr. is a horrible human being.
Terrible.
And stupid. So,
oh yeah.
So I'm not sure going to, within the Republican Party.
I'm not sure that's a downside for most of the base.
No, not in within the Republican Party, but in a general election. Now, of course, if the Democrats put up somebody who's unelectable, that's a different thing. But I don't see these guys. In fact, I think you look at what they don't realize is that you look at J.D. Vance and Marco Rubio, and they don't project that sort of superhuman personality.
No.
That the MAGA porn, MAGA porn is a real thing.
Oh, that, yes.
And
yes.
And I'm not seeing any MAGA porn about either of those guys.
There's the one thing that MAGA really loves underneath all of it is that essential cruelty that Trump has.
The brutality, and,
Yeah, the brutality, the ugliness, the cruelty. These guys don't have that. They could try to fake it. Vance tries to fake it all the time and it looks ridiculous. It looks absurd. But, well, Charlie Sykes, it is going to be a long future ahead of us still. Let's do this more often, my friend.
It's been a long week.
Appreciate you.
All right, Rick.
Appreciate you coming on. We'll see you next time.
All right. Okay, thanks a lot.
The Lincoln Project Podcast is a Lincoln Project production. Executive produced by Whitney Hayes, Ben Howe, and Joey Wartner-Cheney. Edited by Riley Main. Hey, folks, if you want to support the Lincoln Project's work against Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and this MAGA craziness, go to action.lincolnproject.us/helplp. you'd like to get in touch or have suggestions for a guest or a show topic, or just want to say hi, our email is podcast@lincolnproject.us. For our MAGA friends, please, no more nudes. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Good night, and good luck.